From theheart.org radio, you are listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein.
Well, welcome. Eric and I are sitting out here on his porch with his dog Gracie, sniffing around and looking at the sunset. Eric, I want to talk to you about something. I want to see if I can enlist your help.
My help?
Yeah. I think I got to get you to agree with me first.
That's going to be tough.
So this is what happened. Yesterday morning, I was getting dressed, and I was listening. As I was getting dressed, I was, as I often do, I was listening to the Topolog. And because I like to hear your voice in the morning.
I know that's not true.
And you were talking about transparency, you know,
yeah,
and
yeah,
it was
I'm
the recent
that.
One,
I'm
and,
that,
and
right.
I know you are. I think that's great. And the sunlight was coming in, and you were talking about, you know, it was all about kind of disclosure, and you started talking about this paper in JAMA, and I actually think this is a very exciting paper. This is the paper we're looking at, reporting states versus non-reporting states
right.
for acute MI.
Right.
And what happened when they compared these the reporting states to the non-reporting states is they found that the PCI rates for acute MI went down.
Yes.
And it was significantly down. And even in Massachusetts, when they converted to a reporting state, their rates of PCI went down. And what you said, which actually I don't think is accurate, it is the main one of the main findings of the paper. But it's, when you read it carefully, because you inspired me to really dig in and read this paper, which is that there was no difference in outcome in terms of mortality. And actually, if you read the paper carefully, there actually is a difference in outcome. So I want to talk about this a little bit.
You mean that the reporting led to reduced deaths?
Reporting led to increased death. Actually, and it's really very clear. But so I give you my perspective, and the reason I have a perspective on this is personal, because I work in New York part-time, at Columbia,
yeah.
And it's a reporting state. So this is my introduction to this topic. I'm sitting there in the cath lab, just chatting in the control room, and the nurse manager comes up to me and says, we have an acute MI in the emergency room, and this guy is 45 years old, was jogging with his wife this morning. He passed out. His wife did CPR. A doorman, I think on Park Avenue.
Wow.
I don't know how they got up to Columbia, but a doorman did CPR.
Jeez.
He's in a coma, but they, actually the wife did CPR. The doorman called the EMT. They came, they shocked him. They brought him here, he's in a coma, but he's got ST segment elevations.
Uh-huh.
Would you be willing, she says, to do a cath on him, to take him and do an acute primary PCI?
All right.
I looked at her like she was crazy. I said, what do you mean, would I be willing? I mean, is this some option that I have? I thought, you know, that don't I work here and don't I have to do this? And she said, well, some doctors would refuse it because he's not conscious and probably won't regain consciousness, and he's, you know, it was about 20-30 minutes of CPR, and that statistically that's a problem, because you know, it's reporting, and we have to report this, and it could be mortality, 30-day
mm-hmm.
mortality,
mm-hmm.
and I just thought that was, I mean, coming from a place where we don't report, I just thought that was really crazy. And, you know, of course we did it. He had an occluded LED, opened it up. They have a great neuro team. They cooled him. And 2 days later he woke up and he was fine. And
well, that,
to me,
great,
that informs.
That's a great story, yeah.
And the other one that happened with me was a guy, was a doc. He was a doctor in his late 70s with the renal failure. And he had bypass surgery, and he was living off a vein graft that was very tightly narrowed. And I cathed him. I had to cath him from the radial approach because he had Loeysius syndrome. He had no abdominal aortic access.
Wow.
It was completely closed. His blood pressure was 90, and he was living on this vessel with poor LV function. It's the kind of thing you'd put a balloon pump in, or these days do, you know, a pen Pella and just put a stent into. But I suddenly got nervous because I was in New York, because this guy can easily die. I can't put a balloon pump in him. I couldn't. I was really worried about the procedure. And I got the heart team together, and we decided that he should have surgery and repeat surgery, and he actually died that night waiting for the surgery.
Mm.
But I was very much influenced. I found myself, and I wouldn't have known this unless I'd had the personal experience, but I found myself very influenced by the reporting, because I have a very low denominator in New York. I don't do that many cases.
A death
is a problem for me. It gets published in the newspaper, and this is something I wouldn't have thought twice about in California. So that's the kind of background to which I come to when I look at these papers. And this paper from JAMA, one of the interpretations, which is the interpretation you had, was that, well, because of reporting, the doctors were less likely to do inappropriate PCI,
right?
Because people were watching. And that's a good thing, because the overall outcome was the same. There was no difference in MI, if you look at the, at least statistically, difference if you look at the entire population. But actually, there is a difference in MI, and that's the overall. They included non-STEMIs, and you know, it's a 30-day outcome that they're measuring. So as you know, with non-STEMIs, it's hard to get a real. You don't have a lot of mortality with non-STEMIs. It's all with these STEMIs, and particularly the older patients in the Medicare population. So, and actually, there was a difference in overall. It just wasn't significant. It was 12.8% versus 12.1%.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
So it was like, you know, it was a little, but it goes against...
in the wrong direction.
I mean, reporting actually caused a higher mortality rate.
It may not have caused it, but it was associated with it.
Okay,
numerically higher.
Okay. But then, if you look at the STEMIs, it was 13.5% versus 11%. And that was a 26% increase in mortality. And when they risk adjusted it, it was like 35% increase. And the p-value was, you know, 0.04 or something. It was really high. I mean, clearly for STEMIs, and you could argue with the 30-day mortality endpoint, which is the only endpoint. Without, you know, we haven't talked about heart failure, you know, quality of life.
Right.
But clearly, the for the STEMIs, reporting wasn't helping anybody. And if you think about why...
So I see where you're going.
Yeah.
Transparency is making people worse.
Yeah, sure. Transparency. Yeah. And I felt it myself.
But this is a very unusual situation. This is not an elective where you pick up a doctor in a hospital. This is, you know, wherever the ambulance takes you, right?
Yeah.
So this is a little different. I mean, this may not be a proxy for transparency in interventional cardiology, right?
Well, if you think about... mortality and PCI, it's pretty, for elective PCI, it is extremely low, to where I think it's pretty hard to distinguish doctors about mortality. I mean,
I don't think mortality would be the metric here.
That's what everybody uses for reporting.
But I think it ought to be things like not only periprocedural MI, but appropriateness. You know, was there a good indication for doing the PCI in the first place? And then as far as the hospital and operator, the volume and the overall, whether it's emergency bypass surgery or periprocedural infarcts, you know, a composite of all the things that we could agree upon are useful.
The problem with that is, first of all, the problem with that is it's not being done that way. So you have incredible amounts of money and time and energy being spent in New York, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts on reporting.
Right.
And all it's done, it's not helped from, in the acute MI, it certainly hasn't helped. It's supposed to help outcomes. The idea behind reporting really wasn't appropriate use. The idea was to find hospitals and physicians that aren't doing a good job and either should do a better job or should be shut down. At this point with PCI, you know, people are really well trained. It's become a much simpler procedure to do. There's not a lot of variation in Elmira.
You know, in New York, because this is a number of years ago, but they did shut down in Elmira a coronary intervention program because they had very high rates of mortality and emergencies. And as you know, this is dating back into the 90s.
Yeah.
Bypass surgery also regulated and reported. You know, that's led to a much tighter, better outcomes for bypass surgery. But there, again, that's for a much better metrics for that than you have for...
Well, mortality
PCI.
Rates, maybe so, but I mean, I still see, we've reporting in California from bypass surgery, and I see case selection, it really drives case selection.
Well, remember that out-migration paper
published? That's why I was surprised that you had
this. Ohio instead of New York?
You were the first to know that. In fact, we had a journal club at Scripps, you were out of town, but we had a journal club, and your paper was the first thing you presented was your paper on that, so that's why I was surprised you took this attitude, because when there's reporting, it influences your case selection, which means that you're really denying patients care. I think that we we should look at getting rid of reporting altogether.
Okay, but now there's two solutions.
This is strong evidence.
No, but there's two solutions here.
I want you to help me on this.
No, no. One option is that the reporting is made better, that it really captures the critical information, because the poor consumer doesn't know what to do.
Okay, I think
situation.
Volumes are good.
Yeah,
I think that would be a good thing. But the appropriate use, we haven't worked that out yet, and that's another thing we should talk about in a minute. But the problem is we can't agree on what appropriate use is, and you know that may get better,
I think it might be worthy. All you got to do is
peri-procedural MI again is kind of tough right now. There's a lot of discussion about
never
what the definition.
That, I know.
Well, the definition is kind of funky, and also there you can sway the outcome based on your case selection, and there's still a dispute. I know you don't like to talk about this. I don't think we'll get anywhere if we really try to argue it. But whether peri-procedural MI, as it's measured, is really
The CKMB area, there's no question. I agree. There's a little more fuzziness
with the troponin.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. But just think though, if you're the poor patient consumer, the patient advocate, mm-hmm. and you're trying to figure out where to go for an elective procedure, not where the ambulance is taking you somewhere. Wouldn't you rather have all the information possible? And the other thing is, you know, patients are very reticent to say, Dr. Tierstein, how many coronary interventions did you do in the past year? And Dr. Tierstein,
I agree.
How many does your hospital do? They're afraid to ask that kind of stuff because they feel like you take it out on them.
I think reporting volumes is fine, and that's you probably can get that from the LeapFrog kind of data. But
patient can get that?
I have no problem with the volumes, but
okay, so
I think
you're into
you and I should work
already.
On. Well, we should you and I should work on abolishing reporting based on mortality.
Okay.
You're okay with
that? I'm all right with
that. Because I think this paper really
is okay
firm
that.
Evidence to not do it. Because I think it's hurting people. I think we could save lives.
I think you're bringing up a really good point. And certainly, if you fixate on mortality alone, that is totally inadequate.
Yeah.
I agree. But there are some things like I want to know.
Reporting is killing people.
But no, I want to know when a patient goes in the cath lab and has an intervention, was it always accompanied by either unequivocal symptoms, positive functional test, or an FFR, or something that's objective?
Okay, that's the appropriate use. And that we had a
I'm
whole,
into that.
You and I had a nice click and rub about that, I think, didn't we do that
last
year?
That, yeah.
But let's get to that, okay? Because this paper also, I mean, the more I got into it, the more I thought, this paper is amazing. This data is, people have to talk about this more.
It's rich.
Do you realize that the rates of reporting versus non-reporting states, we're talking about 43% versus 38%. That means, when the state became reporting, the rate of PCI for acute infarction went down to 38% from 43%. I don't understand where these patients are not getting PCI. I thought we proved that when you have a heart attack, getting PCI, primary PCI, saves lives. It's a class one indication.
Well, yeah, but there's a time window. There's, as you already mentioned, the ECG criteria that can sometimes be ambiguous, particularly in the non-STEMI.
Okay, that accounts for some of it, but there's probably some underutilization here, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and then there's these, 95-year-olds that come in with an acute MI, and, whether they should get a primary PCI. There's a lot of
Futility argument, which is reasonable, which is not appropriate. It's not part of the appropriate criteria.
Right.
In fact, for ACS, if you remember the appropriateness criteria, it was almost impossible to have an inappropriate PCI for acute coronary syndrome.
That's right.
I mean, the only inappropriate was, I think, if it was more than 12 hours,
or
if you did the non-infarct vessel.
Well,
you could say
cardiogenic shock in someone who's over 75. Should you be doing PCI in those people?
We could argue. Probably, I would say yes.
I think it should be individualized. Yeah. I don't think there should be a rule about that, but that's generally accepted as futility.
Well, the other point that this paper leads to is this whole idea of my mind is underutilization, which brings us to the other paper that was getting a lot of talk at TCT, which I don't know if it's been published yet. It was not published online last week, which is this paper from
published.
Well, I don't know if everyone's read it yet.
Oh,
I should say,
right.
Which was looking at variation revascularization practices. They call it the VRPO registry from Ontario. This is right up your alley because we're so interested in variation practice now. You can, Atul Gawande can write another New Yorker article about it, and it's really fascinating. Look, they looked at 1,600 or so patients with stable angina and looked at 3-year outcomes: mortality, and acute and hospitalization for acute coronary syndromes. That was the endpoint, mortality and acute coronary syndromes causing hospitalizations. And they had nurses go through the charts, and these are patients who had undergone heart caths. So they took it from the level of the heart cath, not the PCI. They took it one step above, and graded the appropriateness for revascularization. And it turns out they had 14% of their patients were revascularized were inappropriate, similar to the NCDR U.S. data, which was 12%. Mm-hmm. But they looked at the flip side, which was the patients who didn't get revascularization, where it was appropriate for revascularization. So it was really
that's
sort of fascinating.
Important. Yeah, that's very.
So do you have any idea what you think the patients who were appropriate and didn't get revascularization, what percentage that was?
Probably pretty substantial.
41% of patients who were graded as appropriate for indications for revascularization didn't get revascularization.
Wow.
Okay. And guess what? So these guys got medical therapy as opposed to either bypass surgery or PCI. So the increase in, it was a 40% increase in death or recurrent ACS requiring hospitalization in the medical therapy patients compared to the revasc patients. So there was a real difference in outcome. Now, you know, it's not a randomized study.
Right, but that's a whopping effect.
But it's pretty, the mortality in ACS, it was, I think, 16 versus 12%. It was big. And even in the uncertain patients, where it was uncertain appropriateness, it wasn't statistically significant, but there was the same difference about the hazard ratio of like 40%. It was really pretty big. And it was statistically significant for the appropriate patients. So, you know, this whole idea of underutilization occurs as well.
Sure.
So, you know, following appropriateness isn't
that hasn't
probably,
been, that hasn't been in the lay press, by the way, very much.
So, of course not. And this is the problem. And this is what frustrates people like me. Why isn't this talked about?
Right.
And the idea of saving money from the appropriate use, you know, if you really do it right, it probably won't save money because
sure.
you probably should be, there are people that ought to be getting revascularization. And a lot of this was surgery, too. So it's not just PCI and weren't getting it. So that's, I think these are two really interesting papers that studies that really,
no, I,
really
I think
can
that,
inform
that,
us.
That topic has not been really emphasized at all. So it's really great that you bring that up.
So I want to enlist you to see if you can. I think you and I should work towards abolishing reporting of mortality rates.
Yeah, I'm with that.
Okay, good.
As long as you don't want to get rid of all reporters.
No, I'm fine with certain things. So we'll focus on the things that we can agree on that are helpful to patients and not harm patients and don't dissuade physicians from taking care of patients.
Well, I think that's part of the problem across all of medicine is that bypass surgery, open heart surgery is kind of the classic where you have mortality, whereas all the rest of things in cardiology and elsewhere, it's very difficult. You don't have that type of one easy to measure metric that is going to be correlated with quality of the operator in the hospital.
Well, part of that is good. I mean, these procedures we're doing now, even bypass surgery, you know, in the at least for straight coronary disease, the mortality rates are low, and that's actually very encouraging. Mortality and urgent bypass rates for PCI are, you know, when was the last time we sent a patient to bypass surgery during a PCI? It's pretty rare. So it becomes more difficult to distinguish. But maybe it's a good thing, though, because, you know, patients are
doing
better.
Did you see that Consumer Reports in the summer where the whole issue was dedicated to how safe is your hospital?
Yeah.
And it had ratings, Scripps Green and Scripps La Jolla and all the hospitals in they could rank. And, you know, it's pretty crude stuff with the red circles and the black circles and all that. I mean, that's very minimal. And that I think that's the kind of thing that you're getting at is it can be quite misleading.
Yeah, and also there's a whole risk adjustment thing. So, and actually one of the interesting things about this, and we could talk about this article a long time, but the article about public reporting is that the public reporting patients states there's a lot more upcoding. Because that's what you do. You really got to capture all of these factors. Whereas if I'm not saying you're falsely capturing, but you're capturing them in the non-reporting states, you're not as concerned about it. Although as we get more and more of all types of reporting, there's increased interest in capturing these risk factors and trying to adjust appropriately. You really can't though. And one of the things you learn is that if you want to have good grades, you better have somebody running around.
Well, you are bringing up a critical point, and that is risk adjustment and how that is done on a population level, not an individualized level. And there are a lot of things that don't, you know, you could maybe adjust for renal function, but there's things of frailty and all sorts
O2
of...
O2 dependence.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of different pieces that you can adjust for, and it's much more granular than what a risk score can account for.
So I can tell you, when I have a patient with triple vessel disease or left main, and I stop and bring the heart team in, I want my surgeon to look at it, and we sort of jokingly amongst ourselves, the fellows and the attending, look at it and say, well, we know which one they're going to reject. And they're smart to do it, because they don't want to do it because the patient's frail or on O2 or they're in a walker, and they don't. That's the kind of patient that's going to be, you know, that's going to have a little bit higher mortality, and that's going to show up in the newspaper.
That's true.
All right. Well, this was an interesting. I think I got you to agree.
I think you got me to buy in. I was reluctant, but I'm coming along. You, when you have such control of the data and read all, I see all your markings and all these papers.
Well, I read the papers carefully here.
How can I not be persuaded by that?
You've been listening to Click and Rub with Doctors Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein on the Heart.org radio, sharing ideas and opinions with the cardiology community worldwide. Find out more on the Heart.org.